This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Go-Giver Influencer, a little story about a most persuasive idea by Bob Berg and John David Mann. Read by the authors. Introduction. It's hard to believe it's been a full decade since the first few copies of The Go-Giver stepped onto the bookshelves to state their message and see if the world was interested in reading about Pindar's paradox, that the more you give, the more you have. Turned out, the world was. Most books enjoy an initial surge of sales and interest, and then taper off to a relatively quiet life in the wings. The backlist, as publishers call it. With The Go-Giver, things went rather in the opposite direction. With each succeeding year, rather than diminishing, interest seemed to keep growing and growing. Something about the book seemed to touch a chord, often in the most unexpected places. Originally positioned as a business book, our little story about a powerful business idea began showing up in book clubs, community groups, sermons, and high school classrooms, as well as in boardrooms and sales and service trainings. CEOs and thought leaders were quoting it. It started becoming not simply popular, but influential. In 2015, our publisher brought out a new expanded edition of the book, with a foreword and introduction, a discussion guide for readers groups, additional commentary, and a curious feature on the back jacket that to us was both fascinating and significant. The handful of endorsements there were bracketed by a pair of quotes from Arianna Huffington and Glenn Beck, not two people whose views you typically expect to find on the same page, whether metaphorically or, as in this case, literally. Which brings us to the reason for the book you're now holding in your hands, and the true meaning and value of influence.
The idea of influence has been at the center of all three Go-Giver books to date. In The Go-Giver, Sam Rosen, the beaming, white-haired insurance man, explains to Joe that grasping the true nature of influence became the key to his success, and that people typically get it backwards. If you asked most people what creates influence, what would they say? Joe's answer came without hesitation. Money, position, maybe a history of outstanding accomplishments. Sam nodded, grinning. Ha! You're right. That's exactly what they'd say. And they'd have it exactly backwards. Those things don't create influence. Influence creates them. He also defined what he called the law of influence. Your influence is determined by how abundantly you place other people's interests first. In Go-Givers Sell More, the third of its five parts, the keystone at the center of the book's arch, expounded and expanded on that law and how it works in everyday real-life operation. In The Go-Giver Leader, in a chapter entitled The Substance of Influence, Aunt L, that book's mentor figure, offers up this definition of influence. Well, she said, hitching forward eagerly in her seat, the word influence means an unseen flow of power. It was first used in the Middle Ages, believe it or not, as an astrological term, from an old French word meaning a streaming ethereal power from the stars acting upon our character or destiny. Imagine that. By the 15th century, the word was being used to mean an exercise of personal power by human beings. You could say it describes how we exert gravitational force on each other, like stars.
We thought Sam, Aunt Elle, and the rest had pretty well summed it up. But the world moves on, and its needs change and evolve. If Pindar and his friends were here today, we wondered, participating in the world of 2018, what would they say? What would they want to write about? Influence, we thought for sure, but perhaps more specifically about the role influence plays in the capacity for empathy and civil discourse. At its heart, The Go-Giver Influencer is a story about what it takes to bridge differences, to settle disputes and defang conflicts, to find common ground where there appear to be only irreconcilably polarized positions, and yes, even to negotiate business dealings.
It is also about what it takes to be the kind of person whom others come to trust, a person to whom others look for sound guidance, clear judgment, and, in times of challenge, even-handed wisdom. A person, in other words, of genuine influence. In recent years, the term influencer has come into widespread usage, a development we greatly appreciate. The more society explores the nature and significance of positive influence, the better off our world becomes. We thought Pindar's friends would have something uniquely Pindarian to say about that, and we hope that once you've arrived at the final toast that closes this story, you'll agree. Bob Berg and John David Mann, January 2018.
Chapter 1. Jackson. Jackson Hill looked like a man waiting to see the executioner. "Are you sure you won't have some coffee?" The young woman at the reception desk had already offered him coffee, a soft drink, and water in that order. "I'm good, thanks though." He liked her energy. The nameplate on her desk said Maribel. "Perfect," thought Jackson. "That's exactly what I need today. A miracle." He glanced at the wall clock. 10 after. 11 now. It had taken 3 weeks just to get this appointment. 3 weeks he couldn't afford to wait. And now the appointed hour had come, and here he was, still waiting. He suppressed the impulse to look at the clock again. After 3 weeks of waiting, another 10 minutes, no, 11, shouldn't matter, right? "Yes," Maribel was speaking into her headset now. "Okay, I'll send them in." She smiled at Jackson and said, "Ms. Waters can see you now. It's straight down the hall on the right." Finally. As Jackson walked past her desk, Maribel leaned forward a little and spoke in a stage whisper, "You're going to love Miss Waters. She's really nice." Jackson hoped that was true. As he took his seat, Jackson noticed a photo on Ms. Waters' desk of a young girl, 12 maybe, curled around a beautiful Russian blue cat, looking at the camera with big solemn eyes that said, "This is my cat. Nobody messes with my cat." The elegant blue stared at the camera too, with haunting green eyes that said, "This is my human. Nobody messes with my human." Jackson smiled. Maybe this meeting would go well after all. "So," the woman said, still looking down at the papers on her desk, "Mr. Hall." "Hill," said Jackson, already feeling defensive. She looked up. "Sorry? It's Hill. Jackson Hill." "Of course, Mr. Hill. Jackson. So," she sat back in her chair to give him her full attention, "tell me about your business." "Showtime." "Sure. So we started with our first line of dry dog food 5 years ago. That was just for dogs, all different sizes and ages. And then within 6 months, we added a cat line." And he went on, just as he'd rehearsed it, chronicling how over the past 5 years he'd built his fledgling business into a respected brand. Of course, when he used the words "we started" and "we added," he was really talking about just himself, Jackson, working solo in his cramped little kitchen, late into the nights and over long weekends, experimenting, crafting, adjusting. "Only the purest," as his company motto went, "only the freshest, only the best." Jackson had in every sense built his business from his kitchen table. "Quite the entrepreneur," said Ms. Waters. He shifted in his seat, unsure exactly how to respond to that. Jackson had never intended to be a business owner. All he wanted was to see animals have the best food to eat. He just had to become an entrepreneur in order to do it. 6 years ago, he was working a sales job for an electronics outlet and hating it, cooking for himself, Walt, and Solomon. When he shared his natural dog food concoctions with a few friends who also live with dogs, word got out. By the time he let go of his sales job to focus full-time on his pet food line, he had more than 100 customers and that widely respected brand, all of which could come crashing down exactly 1 week from today if he didn't get this contract. No, not could, all of which would come crashing down. So you distribute to what now? She was glancing down again, running her finger down the sheet at the top of her little stack of papers. Two states? Three, he said. Almost four, he added, and immediately regretted it. Almost four? What, like holding four fingers up high and proudly saying, these many? You're in business now, Jackie, as Walt would say. You gotta act like it. Three, said Ms. Waters, nodding to her papers. Almost four. She looked up and leveled her gaze directly at Jackson. So, tell me, why do we want to carry you? Jackson winced. He knew she meant to say, carry your products, right? But intentionally or not, she'd certainly nailed it, hadn't she? If they gave him this contract, they would indeed be carrying him. He took a breath. It's simple, really. I love animals. Adore them. Big, small, two-day-old kittens, old hounds on their last legs. Doesn't matter what shape or size or breed or temperament. To me, they are all, every one of them, the noblest, sweetest, kindest, most, well, most authentic creatures. I look at an animal like, he almost said, like your daughter's cat, but would that be getting too personal? Well, like any cat, any dog, and I think they were put here as emissaries of how we ought to be. Emissaries of heaven on earth. Ms. Waters smiled thinly. Hence, the name. Jackson nodded. Exactly. That's how I see them. She looked down at the papers again. Angels clothed in fur. And up again at Jackson. A somewhat unconventional name for a business. We're a somewhat unconventional business, he said, feeling defensive again. Anyway, as I said, it's simple. I want to reach more animals with the best the earth has to offer. Only the purest and freshest. That slogan, I really mean it. And if I can put my product in your stores, well, you can reach a lot more creatures than I can on my own. Understatement of the week. Smith and Banks Pet Supply, the chain Ms. Waters represented, had stores in every state coast to coast. A massive footprint. Or should he say, paw print. Ms. Waters glanced at her papers again, then back at Jackson, and smiled once more, that thin smile that didn't seem to give much away. Well, I've looked through the materials you sent, and I have to say, it's impressive. We like it, and we like you. We are definitely interested in the possibilities. Jackson's heart leapt. He nearly leapt, too, right out of his chair. Impressive. We like it, and we like you. Wow. Then his head caught up. Hang on, did she just say, definitely, possibilities? Wasn't that sort of like saying, for sure, maybe? We think angels clothed in fur could sit very comfortably on our shelves, Miss Waters was saying. Just 2 points. You'd need to supply us on a national basis, of course, and we would want it to be an exclusive arrangement. Jackson's heart stopped. National? Exclusive? National distribution. That would mean he'd either have to ship his products clear across the country, which would be impossible because part of his whole thing was their freshness and emphasis on locally grown ingredients. Or he'd have to set up not one or two, but at least a dozen separate production sites, which would take an enormous investment, which was completely out of the question. And exclusive? Pull out of all his existing clients' stores? Turn his back on all those relationships? It hurt even to think about it. Okay, he said, his heart racing, desperately hoping that she couldn't see how rattled he was. See, I was hoping to start out going into stores in 4 states, maybe 5. I mean, that's what we're geared for at the moment. I understand, she said, but you understand we're a national chain. Providing only the purest, only the best in these 5 states over here, but not in those 5 states over there, well, would that be fair to our customers? Jackson felt his face flush. Would that be a rhetorical question, he wanted to say, but he bit it back. Instead, he just sighed. Silently, he hoped. No, of course, I see your point. But I don't see how... He stopped. How did he plan to finish that sentence? the silence in the room felt positively chilly. He had to say something, but he didn't dare explain his actual situation. Revenue from those early clients had allowed him to take over an old, out-of-business diner. With his own industrial kitchen, he had built out his pet food line and extended his sales to stores across the state. To extend that reach farther to cover three states, well, parts of three states, he'd had to set up a whole new separate production facility in the next state over so he could keep to his standards of freshness and local supply. But setting up and running a new plant from scratch was a lot harder than he expected. The financing he'd gotten to do it was drowning him. The bank had been patient for a year, but now he had to bring his account current or they would call the loan and shut down his operation. A week from today. There was no way under the sun he could come up with the cash. But if he could show up with a large purchase order from a major national company, he was betting, that would halt the process and keep his doors open. A contract with Ms. Waters' company, in other words, might just save him from going under. And at that thought, an idea slipped into his mind, so quietly that it took him a moment to realize it was sitting there waiting for him. "I understand what you're saying," he said. "That makes sense. I see that. Of course, to scale up to that level, I'd need some assistance." For the first time since their meeting had begun, Ms. Waters looked ever so slightly taken off balance. "Assistance?" "Well," said Jackson, "the entire continental United States, that's a good deal of territory. Our whole thing is fresh and local. That's more or less the heart of the brand. The brand you'd be featuring on your shelves. We need to put in place a network of kitchens, production centers. We have several now." He had two, barely. "To supply nationwide, we'd need to set up, oh, a dozen more around the country, I'd expect. A dozen at least. That'd take a little financing." He tried to say this all in an entirely neutral, casual tone. Oh, sure, a dozen plants across the country. What he was planning to do anyway. A little financing? Just saying the words nearly gave him a heart attack. "I don't mean you'd provide actual funding," he added. "That would have to come from my own sources, obviously. But I've never gone into anything on this scale before. The only way it would work, I expect, would be with someone big, someone like Smith and Banks underwriting it. Guaranteeing the loan, I mean." Ms. Waters regarded him with an appraising look. "Right. Well, I can certainly run that past the corner office, see what they say. But to be honest, Mr. Hill, I can't promise they'll be friendly about the idea." Another chilly silence. "Also, you said an exclusive?" She raised her eyebrows, as if to say, "Yes?" That's a tall order. Right now, I supply a lot of stores in our area." She said nothing. "And?" "A lot of these small stores, these aren't just clients, they're friends. People I've known for years. And without whom his business would never have gotten off the ground," he could have added. "Of course," she said. "You've got an existing pipeline, agreements and contracts. We assume there'd be a transition period. Time for you to fulfill your current obligations and gracefully withdraw from future commitments. Work up new marketing collateral for our stores, and so forth. Say, 3 months?" Jackson nodded numbly. Marketing collateral. He hadn't thought about that. Unexpectedly, Ms. Waters' voice softened. "I know. It's a lot." She was silent again for a moment, though this time somehow the silence did not feel so chilly. "Tell you what, Mr. Hill," she said after another moment, "why don't you go back and talk with your people, see what you might be able to work out? And I'll go speak with the corner office here about that underwriting idea. And then we'll meet again, okay? Say, next Friday, a week from today?" A week from today, exactly the words the bank officer had spoken to him that morning, only without the question mark. He stood up, reached over her desk, and shook her hand. "A week," he said. "Thank you." "You've got this, Jackson," he told himself as he slipped past Mirabelle's desk with a nod and a mouthed "thank you." She was on the phone, and showed himself out the door. "You are a successful businessman. You are going to close this deal." But it didn't feel like he was going to close this deal, and he didn't feel like a successful businessman. He felt like a man who had just been to see the executioner.
Chapter 2. Jillian. Jillian stared out her office window, trying to see her future. 10 long years she'd been here. She was smart, and she worked hard, but it had been a struggle just to get where she was. A buyer. Ms. Gray Flannel Suit, Katie would say, poking fun at her. Ms. Mid-Level Executive. Well, that's what she was, and proud of it. Her company did a lot of good, and she was part of that. But she was aiming higher. She wanted that corner office. Everyone in the company knew that the senior VP of distribution was about to retire. It was the company's best-kept secret, ha-ha. Jillian wanted that spot. If she got it, maybe someday she might even run the company. Hey, why not? If she got it, more to the point, she would command a salary that would let her put Beau in that school she wanted, and save for her college, and buy her a horse, and give her the world, because the kid deserved it. Jillian felt her heart lurch. She turned back to her desk and pushed the talk button on the office intercom. Mirabel, she said, could you see about getting me an appointment with the corner office? Sure, Ms. Waters, the voice said back. For when? As soon as he can see me, she said. Monday, hopefully. We'll give it our best shot, Ms. Waters. You're the best, Mirabel, said Jillian, and she clicked off. Only the purest, only the freshest, only the best. When she'd said she was impressed with Jackson Hill's company, she wasn't kidding. His products were good, really good. She'd wanted to meet with him right away when he first contacted their office, but she'd needed a few weeks to research his company and his products. She bought samples, talked with customers, even went out and talked with store owners, including some of his oldest clients. The more she dug, the better it all looked. No doubt to him, she appeared fairly ignorant of his company, but that was just strategy. Better to keep it opaque. Never show your cards, as Craig would say, although look how that had turned out. She didn't feel great about that, but she didn't just want Jackson's line. She needed it. Not only would it be a great account to win, it was an account that could make her career. If she could bring Jackson's unique line in-house, it would be a huge feather in her cap, which would put her within spitting distance of that promotion to senior VP of distribution. Competition for that position would be fierce, no question about it. Jillian was no good at office politics, but she knew this much for certain. If she could land the Jackson Hill account, she would have a shot at it. She turned in her chair and looked outside again, now at the fading light. She didn't want to go home, not just yet. She hated going home when the place was empty. She thought back to their conversation that morning, when she had dropped Beau off at school, and smiled. "Looking forward to seeing your dad this weekend?" she'd said. Beau squirmed in the car seat. "I guess. He's always busy." That was Craig, all right. Always busy. "Busy how?" she'd countered. Beau gave a theatrical sigh. On his laptop and on the phone. Big gestures with both hands. "And stuff." Jillian smiled. "I'm always busy too, Beau Bird." "That's different." "Different how?" "Mom." Her daughter gave her a look that said, "Do I really have to explain this?" "Even when you're busy, you're still here. You're never busy, busy." Jillian felt her heart lurch again, like it did 1,000 times a day. No, not home, not yet. She took a big breath. She was done here for the day. So, if not home, then where? Ha, as if she had to ask. 10 minutes in, and she had already worked up a serious sweat, but she was just getting started. She sat up, reached down and added 5 more pounds to the weight machine, then laid back down on the bench and resumed her overhead chest extensions. Total weight, 30 pounds. Push. Slow release. Push. Slow release. Push. Jillian was ambitious, it was true, but it was more than that. And yes, she wanted a salary that would allow her to take the best care of her daughter, whom she loved with the fierceness of a mother tiger. But if she were honest with herself, it was more than that, too. She wanted to feel her own efforts having an impact, a real impact. That was why she joined this company in the first place. Not just to keep a roof over their heads, but because she wanted to make a difference. She sat up and added more weight, then lay back down and kept going. 40 pounds. She didn't understand Jackson Hill's reluctance. She was offering him something even bigger than what he was asking for. Why wasn't he jumping at it? He seemed strangely uneasy and uncooperative. She could not figure the guy out. Did he want this contract or not? She'd been positive they would end that meeting with at least an agreement in principle, details to be worked out in the days ahead. But he seemed to back up from every term and condition she put on the table. And that request to underwrite his kitchens, she had not seen that coming. He had to know that was a huge ask, big enough that she would now have to go get buy-in from the senior VP himself, the very guy whose position she hoped to land. She sat up and added more weight. 50 pounds. Push. Slow release. She thought about the week ahead. Sunday afternoon, she'd get Beau back. Sunday evening, they would have a blast together. And then Monday. She didn't know which was going to be the bigger challenge, getting the corner office to agree to put its credit behind the financing for Jackson's string of kitchens, or keeping Jackson himself from bolting at the first loud noise, like a skittish colt. When she'd said national and exclusive, she thought she was going to have to hit the intercom and ask Mirabel to bring a defibrillator. 60 pounds. Actually, now that she thought about it, that was easy. No contest. Both challenges were impossible. But she had to walk out of that meeting next Friday with a signed contract in her hand. Had to. She groaned out loud. Were you bad? Jillian paused in her reps and looked up into the face looking down at hers. Even upside down, Katie's bright, freckled face made her want to laugh. What? Were you very bad? I think you've been very bad, 'cause you sure are punishing yourself. Jillian sighed and sat up. Katie was not only her dedicated trainer, but also her best friend. She wasn't sure which she really came here for, the workouts or the talkouts. That one was easy, too. Both. I'm trying to land this account, said Jillian. The one I told you about? Katie nodded as she grabbed Jillian's arm and tugged her over toward another machine. I don't know what the guy's story is, but it feels like I'm pulling up a tree stump with a piece of thread. If I pull too hard, the thread'll break. But if I don't pull at all, I'll just sit there. Like a stump, volunteered Katie. Exactly. Thank you. Sit. Katie had Jillian lie down on the bench, then set the weights and gave her leg a let's go whack. Jillian obediently started doing her leg lifts. 40 pounds. I really need this, Katie. It's the only way I'm going to have a crack at that corner office. The only way I'm ever going to get Beau into that school, etc. Katie nodded. I know, sweetie. I know. Jillian had gone through another 20 reps before it dawned on her that Katie was standing there, just watching her. She dropped her feet down onto the floor, took a big breath, and looked at her friend. What? Maybe you should go see the coach, said Katie. Jillian stood up and put her hands on Katie's shoulders, looking her in the face. Katie, You're not only my best friend and biggest pain in the neck I know, you're also my trainer. My trainer. I don't need to work with another coach. Not a coach, said Katie. The coach. Jillian sat back down on the bench. What coach? She said as she resumed her leg lifts. This guy, said Katie. I think he used to be a football coach or something, like high school. I don't know if he was ever pro or not. But now he's some kind of high-level executive coach, works with CEOs and people in high-stress positions, things like that. Help me, said Jillian. And this miracle-working motivational guru's name is? Katie pursed her lips and thought. I don't think, she shrugged. No, I don't think I ever heard it mentioned. My client, the one who's worked with him, she always just calls him the coach. Says he teaches this thing he calls his winning strategy. Here, Katie fished out her phone as she talked. I'll text you his number. Jillian made a face. Aha, his winning strategy. Fantastic. Probably an axe murderer who lures women like me to their doom with sweet promises of corporate jets and their face on magazine covers. Katie swatted her in the thigh. You're terrible. Jillian nodded. Yes, I am. Now, back to my punishment. She reached forward, adjusted the weights, sat back, grabbed the handles, and continued her reps. 50 pounds. 90 minutes later, Jillian stepped into her front vestibule, closed the door, and heard it go click. She stood, motionless. When Beau was away and the house was empty like this, the silence was so thick it felt as if it had a weight, a density all its own, like a spell cast over a dark forest while a princess slept for a century. She felt something brush against her leg. She looked down and smiled at Cleo, silently twining her tail around Jillian's leg. She mimed blowing a kiss at Cleo without making a sound. For some reason, the silence felt to her like it should not be broken, not yet, like an enchantment, like if she broke the spell, her daughter would never be returned to her, but would sleep in the dark forest forever. She shook her head abruptly. The things a mother thinks, she said aloud. Cleo looked up at her and silently agreed. Jillian slipped off her shoes and padded to the kitchen to make herself a cup of hot tea. A high school football coach. Seriously? His winning strategy? Give me a break. While waiting for her tea to cool enough for a sip, Jillian Waters sat on a kitchen stool, staring out the window, trying to see her future. After a few minutes, she reached into a pocket and pulled out her phone.
Chapter 3. The Dog Park. When Jackson arrived home, his place was the opposite of empty. The commotion began when he was still 10 feet from the entrance. By the time his hand was on the doorknob, it had escalated to a 5-alarm ruckus. He opened the door and was immediately swallowed in an onslaught of crushing weight, hot breath, and a tongue the size of a hand towel. "Whoa, buddy!" Jackson collapsed under the massive dog, laughing and protesting and giving up all at the same time. When Solomon was present, all available space was taken up, no matter how big the space was. His 150 pounds could fill a small couch. His personality could fill an auditorium. When Solomon greeted you, you stayed greeted. "I love you too, buddy." By way of agreement, Solomon took 2 steps back and shook off. Solomon shaking himself always created a burst of sound, all clanging collar and tags and rapid-fire back-and-forth whapping of those big ears. It sounded to Jackson like a helicopter coming in for a landing at close range. What did they call the president's helicopter? Marine One. A new nickname. Meet my dog, Marine One. Whenever Saul shook off, Jackson would now imagine the first few bars of Hail to the Chief. "Hey, buddy." Solomon now came to a complete stop, eyes and ears glued on Jackson to catch his next words. "Want to hit the trail?" Now there was a rhetorical question. Before Jackson had finished the word trail, Solomon was steamrolling down the front hall, and a moment later, here he was, back again, leash in his mouth. "Taking Saul to the park," Jackson called out as he hooked leash to collar. From somewhere in the apartment's interior, a reply drifted back. "Yep." Man of few words was Walter Hill. Sometimes, anyway. "Back soon," he added, and left without expecting an answer. Jackson loved taking Solomon out for walks. Though, to be fair, it would be more accurate to say it was Solomon who took Jackson. It didn't take long to catch up with Lily and Keith. Lily, Keith's pit bull, was a rescue dog. She was also one of Solomon's favorite dog park dates. This was Jackson's favorite part of the whole Solomon walking experience. He loved watching the dogs meet up, the enthusiasm, the sheer unbridled joy of it. It was one of the biggest reasons he so loved being around dogs. They always reminded him to appreciate the miracle of simply being alive, sniffing the air, feeling the breeze, the unabashed exuberance of being able to rock it, or even just to walk, for heaven's sake, just look at poor Keith, through space on a pair of legs, or two pairs. The things human beings seem to take for granted, but dogs never did. Keith was a retired fireman, although Jackson thought retired probably was not really the right term for someone still in his 50s. Some years back, he'd been in a bad accident on the job and was now living on disability. His right leg didn't function that well and never would, but he worked it every day, taking it out for long walks with Lily, whose legs worked just fine. For the 100th time, Jackson marveled that he and Keith were friends. They were from entirely different generations, different neighborhoods, different life experiences. There was very little they agreed on, and absolutely nothing they had in common. The two men stood side by side, watching the spectacle of Solomon and Lily turning in circles around each other and sniffing each other all over. Okay, one thing in common. The dogs now took off across the park, and the two men started ambling along the path while the dogs careened back and forth, circling and chasing each other madly, taking turns as lion and gazelle, playing catch and growl and release, grinning and throwing off strings of drool, and having the kind of full-out delighted playtime that only dogs and children seem to speak as their native tongue. The two men chuckled. "Damnedest thing, isn't it?" said Keith. "They see each other, and it's the world's greatest reunion, like they've been apart for 10 years. The World War II sailor kissing the nurse in Times Square." "I know," said Jackson as they walked. "I love it." For some odd reason, watching those dogs having the time of their lives brought him back to those miserably tense minutes in Ms. Waters' office. Not a whole lot of enthusiasm and unbridled joy in that meeting, that was for sure. All at once, Jackson felt glum. "Animals, I understand," he added. "It's people I have a hard time getting." "Huh," Keith gave a brief sideways glance. "Hard day at the office, dear?" That got a laugh out of Jackson. No matter how lousy he felt, Keith could always get him laughing. "You could say." He laid out the situation for Keith in broad strokes. "So," he concluded, "we meet again next Friday. And if I don't walk out of that meeting with a contract in my hand, I'm out of business. It's over." "Huh," said Keith again. He picked up some gravelly dirt, rubbed it between his hands, then tossed it down again. Jackson never knew why he did that, but it seemed to help him think. "Jackson, you are dog's best friend, and a stellar human being at that. But when it comes to understanding the subtleties of business, you are a few pups short of a litter." Jackson sighed. "You need to learn some tricks of the trade, my friend." "And which trade would that be, Keith?" Keith gave Jackson his signature, "What are you, an idiot?" look. "Business, man. You have to close your deal, right? You need to learn how to negotiate, maneuver. Tricks and tactics, man. Tricks and tactics. You need to sharpen your skills. Jackson said nothing. Hey, it's a dog-eat-dog world out there. Why did people always say that? Jackson had never known a single dog who ate another dog. On the other hand, he'd seen plenty of people get pretty carnivorous toward other people. Take his father, for example. He dreaded the thought, but no doubt he would have to tell him about today's disastrous meeting. Walt would drag it out of him. Keith broke the silence. Ever tell you what happened when I went to court over my leg? Jackson frowned. I thought you said it never went to court. Keith squinted into the distance, looking at who knew what, and nodded. Huh, so you were listening. You're smarter than you look, doggy boy, you know that? Jackson ignored his friend's sparring. So what happened when you didn't go to court over your leg? As a matter of fact, said Keith, we were indeed all prepared to go. Court date set and everything. We'd hit an impasse. A stalemate. The city wouldn't go above X. I wouldn't come down to anything less than Y. He stopped for a moment, threw another handful of dirt, and then walked on as if he'd finished the story. You're going to make me sit up and beg, aren't you? Said Jackson. Okay, I'm asking. So what happened? Keith grinned broadly. He was missing several teeth, but those he had were all in excellent shape. Feed a lot of dogs, thought Jackson, and you notice these things. Well, this lawyer stepped into the breach and got me a sweet deal, a deal even better than the best I'd hoped for. Way better. I mean, way better. Jackson whistled. City must have been mighty upset about that. That was the weird thing about it. They weren't. Not even a little. The way she worked it out, they were as happy as I was. It was total David Copperfield, man. Blew my mind. Wow, said Jackson. Where'd you find that lawyer? Keith huffed out a short burst of a laugh. I didn't find her. She found me, you could say. Jackson gave him a look of puzzlement, which seemed to satisfy Keith. She wasn't my lawyer, man. She was theirs. And she wasn't exactly a lawyer. Jackson stopped walking and looked at his friend. Wait a minute. That makes no sense. So they brought in a lawyer, and she got you a deal? How does that work? And what do you mean, not exactly a lawyer? She was actually a judge, retired judge, strictly speaking. He looked at Jackson. Beg for your treat. Jackson laughed. You are an evil man, Keith. Okay, I'm begging. What's the punchline? Keith nodded approvingly. Good boy. Here's the deal, okay? Retired judge, now she spends her time settling disputes. Teaches this thing she calls natural negotiation. And she calls it that, why? Keith shrugged. Not the first clue. You'll have to ask her that yourself, won't you, doggy boy? Jackson had been right about their dinner conversation. He'd barely put the food on his plate and taken the first bite when Walt said, So, how'd it go? Giving as little detail as possible, Jackson described what had happened in his meeting with Ms. Waters that afternoon. Well, there you go, said Walt. Jackson desperately did not want to take the bait, but he couldn't help himself. What do you mean, there you go? Walt put his fork down and looked at his son. That right there, when she dropped her little bomb about going national, that was your moment. Jackson sighed. My moment for what, Pop? Walt picked back up his fork, speared a bite, and used it to point at his son. The flinch. You should have used the flinch. He snapped the bite off the fork, worked his jaw a few times, swallowed, and continued. So it goes like this. Someone pitches you a price. You know it's nowhere near the strike zone, missing the plate by a mile. But they're just testing you, seeing if you'll swing for it. So what you say is, you don't say anything. You react. Facially, understand? You just react. Don't make a big deal out of it. Just enough so they see it. Like you didn't mean to do it, but their offer was so insulting you couldn't help yourself. It's intimidating, It intimidates them. They go, "Oh, but we could probably go lower." He barked a short laugh. "You don't even say a word, and they fold right up. Works every time, every single time." He looked down at his plate and went on eating. "The flinch," he said, talking to his plate, "never fails." Oh, I flinched all right, thought Jackson, though it had really been more of a wince than a flinch. He'd practically dropped to the floor and crawled under the desk. Duck and cover. No, he was pretty sure his reaction had not been anything that Walt would have seen as a power move. That, or you could have used the challenge. How it works, you just look them right in the eye and say, "Can you do any better than that?" Makes it sound like their offer was so weak it wasn't even worth crediting. Like you can't believe they aren't even doing their job. Like, "Excuse me, you can't be serious. If we're going to have a little joust here, you have to at least hold up your end of the stick." Ha! Jackson sighed, silently. It occurred to him to point out that the problem wasn't that Ms. Waters' price was too low. They hadn't even talked price. It was that her terms were A, impossible, B, out of the question, and C, would crush his soul even if they were possible. But he couldn't quite see explaining that to Walt. Walt had been a ruthless negotiator in his day, quite tough as a dad, too. These days, though, Walt had mellowed a little. Or maybe it was just that he'd gotten too weak from age and illness to be as domineering as he once was. In any case, since Jackson's mom passed away, he and Walt had arrived at a sort of uneasy truce and worked out their rhythms of how to live together as two bachelors. Jackson kind of liked having him around, if he were to tell the truth, even if he was not at all sure to what degree Walt felt the same way. No, Walt didn't bother him, and having to submit his daily business dealings to Walt's scrutiny didn't bother him. He didn't even mind listening to Walt's going on and on about how things should be done, even if it did make Jackson cringe to think about it. And it certainly did do that. The flinch. The challenge. Just the thought of being so calculating and devious made him want to shudder. "You need to learn some tricks of the trade, my friend," Keith had said. "Tricks and tactics." Oh, he knew all about those from Walt. But no, that wasn't what bothered him. What bothered him was this. What if Keith and Walt were right? Because he had to admit, whatever he was doing now, it certainly wasn't working.
Chapter 4. The Judge. Jackson awoke the next morning with a single thought. The judge. He sat up, and before his feet had touched the floor, he was already debating with himself. Really, Jackson? Tricks and tactics? Was he seriously thinking of doing this? But then, Keith's story, the settlement he got, that was pretty impressive. So, was he really prepared to go lay out all his cards, spill his most painful secrets to a perfect stranger? Sure, he could do that. Or perhaps he could spend an equally pleasant afternoon jamming his fingers into electrical outlets around the house. He looked over at Solomon, splayed out on his gigantic dog bed on the floor, still deep in sleep. Except that the moment Jackson had moved, Saul's ears had pricked up to alert status. "I may be asleep, but I'm still on duty." Jackson shook his head, smiling. Canis fidelis. He pitied the person who would dare try anything on Jackson when Solomon was around. Maybe he should bring Solomon to the meeting next Friday. He dropped his little debate, felt silly for even having it. This wasn't about Jackson and his tender ego. This was about saving his company. This was about feeding a lot of dogs and cats, don't forget the cats, the best food in the world. He reached for his phone and pulled over the slip of paper on which Keith had scrawled a number at the dog park. He would leave a message, hopefully get a call back Monday. Although it would probably take 2 or 3 weeks just to get an appointment, which of course would be the classic case of shutting the stable door well after the horse had fled. But he had to try. He dialed the number and pushed send. Celia Henshaw said a voice. Jackson waited for the rest of the recorded message to play out, then realized it was not a recorded message at all. Hello, I'm sorry. Is this Judge Henshaw's office? Speaking. It was a deep, rich voice, melodic, with a good dollop of southern accent. Not Georgia, milder. Memphis? Louisville? Sorry, said Jackson. I thought I didn't expect to actually reach anyone. I mean, I didn't mean to disturb your Saturday. You're not disturbing it, said the voice. Just participating in it. Ah, okay, he said. A friend gave me your number. Keith Davis, retired firefighter? Of course, Keith. How is he? He's still Keith. The voice chuckled. And Lily? Oh, Lily's great. There was a pause. Why don't you tell me a little about your situation? Okay, sure. I run a food company for dogs and cats, a pet food company. We sell mainly here in state, and some to a few surrounding states, mostly through small stores. A rich, throaty laugh came cascading through the phone. Charlie Parker on tenor sax. Angels clothed in fur? Said the voice. That's right. How did you... You must be Jackson Hill, she said. I've been so curious to meet you and thank you. I love your work, as they say in Hollywood. Jackson was as tongue-tied as a teen at his first dance. We have 5 cats, the voice explained. And no, before you are too polite to ask, I am not the city's crazy cat lady. That's my husband. He can't say no to strays and the indigent, which I have no problem doing, but saying no to him, well, that's not among my strengths. She laughed again. Jackson thought you could probably spread that laugh on waffles and serve it to kings. Our cats thrive on your food. 6 weeks on it, and they're different creatures. So much happier, so much healthier. It's really something. So, thank you. Oh, you're so totally welcome, Jackson replied. I'm really glad to hear it. There was another brief pause. So, said the voice. Oh, right. So, I'm in a difficult negotiation right now. He briefly described his situation, the contract he was hoping for, the bank loan looming over his head. He couldn't believe he was sitting in his pajamas and, sure enough, telling all this to a perfect stranger. No electrical outlet finger jamming for him today. All right, she'd said after he finished. What's your outcome?
My outcome?
What do you want out of all this? Well, said Jackson, I can't see pulling out of all my friends' stores, but it doesn't look like I have much of a choice there, though I'd really rather not, if there were any way it could be avoided. And the whole going national thing, to be honest, that kind of terrifies me. But I guess the most pressing thing right now has to be that bank loan. I mean, that could just be game over. End of story. What I really need is that contract. If I can close this deal, I'm pretty sure that will get the bank to back off and give me some breathing room. There was a silence. All right, said the judge. I don't think I heard any, this is what I want, in there. You just described a lot of problems. What do you want? Right, well, I guess what I want is for the bank to give me some leeway, so I can keep growing my business at a pace that feels manageable. Yet another brief silence. All right, is that what you want? Really want? Jackson thought about that for a moment. Let me ask you a different question, said the judge. What do you have?
What do I have?
Yes, what do you have right now that you love, that gives you joy, that makes you say, yes, this is the whole point? Jackson nodded, then realized she couldn't hear that over the phone, and added, okay, I see what you mean. He paused for a moment. Woof. Said Solomon quietly. Jackson looked at him.
Solomon looked back at Jackson, who smiled, and said into the phone, I have a dog, a humongous, a slobbery, affectionate, noble beast who gives new meaning to the word faithful. And I have a ton of other animals, too. I don't mean here at home. I mean animals I see at the stores where we deliver. Animals I've gotten to know. I love seeing all the pets our food feeds and all the people who come with those animals. How much richer their lives are with those animals as part of them. Honestly, I love hearing you tell me how your husband's 5 cats are thriving, and knowing that it was the long hours in my cramped little kitchen, experimenting, adjusting, developing these products that helped make that happen. That's what I have that I love. There was another pause, this one long enough that Jackson wondered if they were still connected. Do I still have you? Oh, yes, she said. Yes, you do. Well, Jackson Hill, that was beautiful. There was a brief silence. Then she continued. So, here's my experience. When you're not sure what you want, look at what you have that you love, that gives you joy. Chances are excellent. What you want is more of that. Jackson felt strangely warmed by her words, but at the same time, confused. How would any of this help him close his deal, nail down that contract, find his way out of this impossible situation? If only it were that simple, he murmured. I know, said the voice. It really is, you know, she added. As simple as that. Alas, though. She sighed. We're not. We make it complicated, tie it up in knots. That sounded about right to Jackson. Tied up in knots. Yep, as Walt would say. So how do you untie those knots? Said Jackson. Ah, said the voice. That is the $64,000 question, isn't it? Which is where you come in. Yes. It was a little unnerving, the degree to which she did not fill in the silences by indulging in embellishment or small talk. So, can I ask you a question? Said Jackson. Of course. Why do you call it natural negotiation? Why do you call your product natural pet food? Because there's nothing artificial added. Could you hear a smile over the phone? Jackson could swear that he just did. That's a negative statement, she said. You just told me what it isn't. What is it? What makes it natural? Jackson didn't have to think about that. It's what these animals really want to eat, if they're given a choice. What really works for them, like for the way they're designed. Exactly, she said. You said it perfectly. Same here. Jackson waited for a moment, hoping she would explain further. But instead, she said, You were calling to see if you could get an appointment, yes? Yes, that's right. It seemed like a month ago that he'd dialed the number. How long had they been talking? Why don't you come by my office for breakfast Monday morning, say 8 o'clock? She gave him an address. Okay, he said. Thank you. That would be great. All right, then, she said. Goodbye, Jackson. Click. It wasn't until he set the phone down that it occurred to him what she'd just said before that. Come by my office for breakfast. Wait, for breakfast? He looked over at Solomon. Solomon said, Woof, and hauled himself up onto his feet to start his day.
Chapter 5. The Coach. At the same moment that Jackson Hill set his phone down, Jillian Waters was knocking on the door of a little two-story house on a street downtown the locals called The Row. The homes-turned-offices on The Row housed art studios, independent recording studios, small publishing houses, even a pottery studio. Down the block, there was some sort of vegetarian cafe and juice bar. not exactly a neighborhood where Jillian would have expected to find a high-level executive coach. On a wild goose chase, Jill, she thought, or are you the goose? Oh, well.